Whatever. I'm sure I signed an NDA, but who cares? It's been long enough.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also thrilled to welcome back special guest Guy English. Guy builds fine apps as one half of Aged and Distilled, as a host of the excellent podcast Debug. In his previous life, Guy developed games at Ubisoft. Hi, Guy.
Hello.
So our topic for today is 3D APIs, the various libraries that developers building apps, at least 3D apps and games, are using to interact with the hardware, and the kind of the stories that have gone from maybe the early days through to Metal, which is sort of Apple's new 3D API, which I definitely would like to get talking about. Guy's written a couple articles on recently, so that was kind of the genesis of bringing up this topic. But in order to kind of discuss it in context, I think probably it makes sense to go back in time to OpenGL. So for those who don't know, the OpenGL was kind of the first big standard, or I think it was the first big standard graphics API, and maybe there's some previous one that was maybe even before that.
I think there was like a non-OpenGL, like just GL at one point,
It was RSGL on the Silicon Graphics machines.
Right. And so Silicon Graphics and these other sort of high-end graphics workstations, which I understand were basically machines that were developed with the purpose of doing graphics, you know, in the 80s and early 90s. And they got together to do a sort of standardized API that different manufacturers could build their hardware and their software to do. And it originally was not for 3D acceleration as much as just have an API where you can do drawing calls and things like that to build CAD applications for doing architecture and things like that. And that early API, you know, is in a lot of ways similar to what I learned when I was first learning graphics programming in university, which is the sort of direct mode, like you say GL open or GL begin, it is. GL begin, and then you just say like, okay, so there's a circle here, or there's a, you know, you can tell it high level things like there's circles and there's a line and there's this, okay, draw some stuff in this color and then rotate it in this way. And then once you've told it a bunch of things, you say GL end, and then it may actually draw it on the screen, which at the time, that's, you know, it was a pretty reasonable way to design API. And now on modern OpenGL, that's not even possible. so how do we get from the sort of origins of OpenGL, where everything is sort of direct and explicit, and get to where we are now, where the exact opposite is the case?
Well, I mean, like you said, you used to set up all your camera stuff, doing the GL rotate and the translate and setting the field of view and all of that kind of fun stuff. And then say GL begin and end, and between the begin and end, you would basically submit each vertex. A vertex is a point in 3D space, and attached to each vertex is the color of it, it's the position in space, and any of the texture coordinates you're going to want to use. So for each one of those, you'd call a specific function like GL color or GL vertex or what have you. And each one of those would add a vertex. And internally, behind the scenes, what was happening, not all the time, but for at least for modern equipment, the driver would just buffer all of this stuff up. And when you said GL end, it would submit it in one chunk to the hardware. These days, due to the overhead of calling all of these functions to go down into the, because every time you call a GL function, you more or less have to dig, you have to call into the driver. And for a lot of that, that means a process change, right? You need to drop down to kernel space. And so these days, the preferred way of submitting vertex data is you build a giant array, like, you know, like a standard C array with each struct. It's an array of structs, and each struct would have like the color information and the vertex information and the texture information. And then you would submit that as one big chunk to OpenGL. And you can tell OpenGL where each relevant piece of data is inside the struct.
So they built up this whole API around peeking and poking at the driver, just like poke, here's a vertex, here's another vertex, here's another vertex. But then next thing you know, there's millions of vertexes and it's expensive to set each one. And I found that kind of amusing, knowing that now the way to do things is not to do the individual vertexes, and it's actually not even possible in modern OpenGL, like OpenGL ES that we have on our iPhones and stuff. But I was actually looking through the history, and in the original OpenGL, it wasn't even possible to set multiple at once. That wasn't even in the original spec. And eventually they're like, oh, maybe you might want to be able to specify more than one at once. And now it's like the kind of the only way to do it is these giant arrays of it.
Yeah, it hadn't really occurred to them that you'd have that much data, that the overhead would become like a real issue.
The thing about early graphics hardware is that what it was competing with, like sort of the whole history of graphics programming up until like the mid 80s when the SGI hardware accelerated hardware started becoming, I mean, not mainstream, but at least mainstream within computing, is your graphics API was you had a enormous chunk of memory that was your frame buffer, and you put bytes in it that represented the colors that you want to appear at particular locations on the screen. And that was basically it. Like almost all graphics APIs, you know, were some variation on that. There were a few things that were a little weirder that you could do, but you know, most of it was that. And that's what the early use of the graphics API was competing with, is we said, okay, well, what we're gonna do is we're gonna provide hardware accelerated rasterization of polygons, right? You give us 3 points for a triangle and we'll fill in all the colors in between. And that was so much faster hardware accelerated than, you know, than something that was just doing that all on the CPU of like poking each byte in individually, that, you know, that seemed like that was kind of the most important thing. Now, you know, as things have advanced and things have got more sophisticated and you've got way more stuff going on the GPU, and all of the transformation is done on the GPU as well. And you have things like character skinning, where you're transforming different vertices in the model to different places based on some underlying skeletal structure and stuff like that. You know, more and more stuff just keeps getting pushed onto the GPU. And now we've got all of the like compute shader stuff coming down the pipe, where you're not even rendering anymore. You're just saying, here's some input data, run this shader on it and give me back the output data that you produced. And for certain problems, the hardware is so much faster at that. The GPU hardware is so much faster than the CPU is, that, you know, that's a valid way to work to get some performance.
You can actually see some weird history in the language when you say that, right? Like you call it a compute shader. A shader historically being a little program you write that decides how to shade a part of a triangle, but you're actually then in that case, it's not shading anything. It's just a thing that operates this little program on a large number of bytes or numbers or whatever. That, you know, shading is no longer part of the equation at all. It's just a little...
Yeah, it's like a nomenclature collision almost at this point.
Right.
It's a program that you upload to the GPU. Even GPU is a bit of a nomenclature problem at this point.
Yeah, for sure. It's more just like almost a GPU could be in more like the parallel processing unit.
Yeah, like a massively parallel processor.
Right. Which is what they actually, I think they called it on the PS3, there was parallel or PPUs.
The SPUs. Stream processing units.
Yeah.
Which is mostly what a modern GPU is now, is like this thing that just takes huge amounts of bytes and converts them into huge other types of bytes, whereas a CPU is much more about branching logic and things like that.
Yeah, so the SPU on the wow, so many letters flying around. The SPU on the PS2.
PS3.
PS2
had the VPUs.
Yes, those were horrible. those were very, very... Anyway, and this will come up later, they have a shared memory access with the CPU. And GPUs, in the way that we're discussing them now, or at least in this era of OpenGL that we're talking about, they don't have that. You'd have to upload all of your data to the graphics card. So it's a bit of a different... It is a massively parallel thing, but you use them in very different ways. Like, it's very hard to use a GPU's processing power to apply to audio in real time. because there's a latency between getting it from the CPU up to the GPU and then back down.
Because the GPU and the audio hardware aren't connected to each other, so you need to then get it back over to the hardware for the audio.
Yeah, they're like little islands of memory.
Right.
That you need to bus stuff back and forth.
And if you are playing back audio and you don't get, fill up its little audio buffer in however many milliseconds, it's going to run out and the audio is going to stop, which we've learned the hard way with our audio apps.
iOS. Yeah. Well, you get latency and, ideally you don't want latency when you're doing audio work.
Yeah, especially in a game. So looking at the sort of those early days of to kind of give some context for where we are now, we have this, OpenGL API, and we have the kind of beginning of 3D accelerated graphics cards. So there's this explosion suddenly, there's these high-end workstations, but as the sort of PCs are coming along and 3D, they're starting to get into, I guess this is in the 90s.
Late
90s. And, Quake and these other 3D shooters are pushing a demand suddenly that we all want machines that have hardware acceleration. They leave the lab and they're no longer a military or CAD specific tool, and every computer or almost every computer purchaser wants some sort of 3D acceleration.
Well, there was actually a bit of a phase before that where not everyone did want one. Like that was right around the time I started in the games industry, so I'm unusually familiar with this transition, but there was a period there where 3D graphics hardware was still fairly exotic, and it wasn't something even generally that could outperform software rendering from a frame rate standpoint, except with regards to being able to render higher resolution, right? Like you'd say, this piece of hardware can't render polygons any faster than we can in software, but we can only run it like 640, 480 in software, but we can bump it all the way up to like, 1024, 768 in hardware accelerated mode. And the rasterization is fast enough to keep up with that. And during that phase, hardware accelerated and non-hardware accelerated kind of lived side by side, and you really had to support both in any PC game for a period of about 3 years or so there between when hardware accelerated started becoming something that people had till just every piece of graphics hardware that you could possibly purchase had hardware 3D acceleration. And you had these weird beasts like the original 3D effects card, the Voodoo, which is not... It like was the first really good piece of hardware acceleration, but was also one of the weirdest pieces of hardware acceleration that you'd have to deal with, because it didn't actually, it wasn't actually a 2D card at all. Like you couldn't run Windows or anything on it. You actually hooked it up by putting it in another slot in your card, and then you had a little 4-inch VGA cable that you plugged into the output of your video card and into the input of the 3D effects card. And then you plug the output of the 3D effects card out to your monitor. And when you turned on 3D, it would basically just like shut off your old graphics card signal and just be showing you the 3D effects card's output.
Which is so crazy. Like until you mentioned that, I had no idea that this was ever a thing, but I used computers that had this in them, but it's just this weird hack where, the 3D specialized hardware was different enough than the 2D hardware that they're just making cards that only did 3D, and you were like, oh, well, maybe you also want like Windows and like DOS and ability to, edit word processing documents. So you're going to actually have both in there, which is a cost problem for them, right?
And in the case of 3D effects, like they could get away with it because their hardware was really good compared to everything else that was out at the time. Like there was a much wider range of hardware than there was today. Yeah, there was S3 and Matrox and like a bunch of people that aren't even in the market really anymore. And all of their cards were pretty crummy compared to the 3D effects cards. Like they were two or three times faster than sort of the average ones, and 10 times faster than the worst ones. And so gamers put up with it. And that was, like I said, this was this period where 3D hardware was still something exotic, right? It was something where you decided, all right, I care about games enough, and I think that there's enough of the games out there that I want to play that support 3D hardware acceleration. So I'm going to go and buy a 3D hardware acceleration card just to be able to play those games. And in a market like that, something like the Voodoo that had this kind of weird behavior was worth it. But it, and eventually 3DFX ended up getting forced out of the market because they just couldn't adapt quickly enough to the realities of, yeah, these hardware accelerations are just, cards are just getting folded into the 2D graphics cards, and the, you know, the bargain brand 2D graphics cards are getting good enough that most people aren't going to care. And they're just, there wasn't the market for anything weird anymore, and they couldn't build cards that were competitive from a cost and 2D windowing performance standpoint with their competition. And they ended up getting forced out of the market.
I was reading about that a little bit because you were talking about it, and apparently they did initially, like, they were starting to get pounded by this by ATI and NVIDIA, who are, you know, ended up, as we know, winning. But they rushed to release out a card which they called the Rush, which was basically a normal Voodoo card, but with some off-brand 2D chip stapled to the side of it. So it was, like, more expensive and worse, and that did not do super well, apparently.
I was going to say that was the era of sort of vendor-specific APIs too, right? Because the Voodoo used Glide, didn't even use OpenGL.
Yeah, and Glide there was some success with. Interestingly, all of the other vendors also had that. The reason I know that is that was my very first job in the games industry. I got hired at Radical to write the graphics driver layer for the S3 and ATI cards, because we'd made the call at the time, because Direct3D at the time was just a complete tub of crap, and OpenGL, you know, was good on some high-end cards, but wasn't good enough on the consumer cards. And so we were like, all
yeah,
right,
and Microsoft had a weird story about supporting it too, right? Like, you need the ICDs, the installable client drivers, and a whole
yeah,
bunch
and
other.
Execute buffers, which was their, like, way of yeah. dealing with the hardware at the time, was really weird, and they were pushing retained mode, which was like a scene graph API
That's
that nobody wanted to use.
Idea.
Yeah. And yeah. so we made the call at the time, or they made the call before I started of, okay, we're just going to like write an internal abstraction layer and just support all of these technologies. So we had like a Direct3D version and a Glide version. And I can't remember what the name of the S3 and the ATI ones were, but they had like their own vendor specific graphics APIs. And in addition to trying to support Direct3D, but then finally, Microsoft got their act together with, I can't remember if it was DirectX 3 or DirectX 5. Like, I think it was one of those two. They finally kind of got their act together.
DirectX 3 is, I think, when they first introduced Direct3D.
Yeah, so it must be
so
DirectX.
DirectX 5.
Yeah, it must be DirectX 5. They finally, like, scrubbed away retain mode and scrubbed away all the execute buffer stuff and you know, introduce draw primitive, which is basically like the API that you want, the one that looked,
yep.
you know, everything kind of looked just like OpenGL. If you had all these functions to set a bunch of state on the device, and then you had a function say, okay, draw this array of graphics data now. And,
yeah.
and you know, then that was the point at which it kind of was clear.
But yeah, it was C++-y, but I mean, very, very in the flavor of OpenGL.
OpenGL is a pretty object-y API itself. I think that's actually one of the things that kind of makes it hard to work with, is that it's an object-oriented C API, and it's been object-oriented badly. Like, that it's got all these weird edge cases of,
yeah.
okay, it's not that you're, like, passing in a handle to each call saying what thing I'm working on. It's that you're binding all this stuff, and you have this, like, global black box kind of state that you're just like, you know, you got a bunch of rods sticking out of it, and you're just poking at the stuff that's inside, and you don't really know how it's configured. Whereas Direct3D, because it's a, you know, COM object-oriented C++ API, that model, like, it's very clean of like, here's a texture object. And are there any properties associated with textures? Yes, you set them on this texture object.
Right. Yeah, like, rather than the OpenGL way of like, you know, you generate a texture ID. And you know what? A lot of demo code didn't even bother doing that. It would just start with texture ID 0 and just keep using them, because apparently that works.
A lot of demo code does things that apparently just works.
Yeah, anyway. But yeah, so I think Quake GL is sort of the tipping point here.
So this is Quake being probably, obviously, complete blockbuster first-person shooter, a game that's making everyone really wake up and understand, okay, I want 3D performance on my PC. And this is the one where originally it didn't support OpenGL, right?
Yeah, it didn't support OpenGL.
Yeah, it was software rasterized in like the release version of it.
Yeah, and then he went and did, was it Quake World?
Was no, it Quake World was like a version, like GL Quake and Quake World were kind of the two experimental versions of Quake that I think probably eventually merged into like one release, but Quake World was like the network version. Like Quake, original Quake was only playable on LAN. It wasn't really playable over the internet. And then Quake World introduced all of the stuff that we think of as like
stuff. Yeah.
modern networking approaches of like client side prediction and stuff like that.
That is definitely also an episode.
Yeah. Sure. And then GL Quake was basically like a port of Quake to OpenGL. And I think we talked about this even like last week or the week before, but Carmack basically implemented on like workstation class hardware and then would tell people, I think originally 3DFX, but I think other people eventually got in on the act of like, all right, here's the exact list of what OpenGL calls I'm calling and with which parameters. If you can give me a DLL that implements those, then Quake will work on your hardware. And everyone was like, you know, when Carmack said jump, everyone asked how high.
Right. Yeah, you basically have Quake drivers. Like, it was the subset of OpenGL that Quake used. And if you go beyond that, well, good luck. You're in the weeds.
And then, of course, any game wants to use the Quake engine then, because if you're like, well, I want to build Hexen. What can I build it on? Well, let's build it on this engine that uses exactly every API that the cards support and no more.
Right, exactly. So for a long time, OpenGL was kind of anemic, or at least spottily implemented. For some reasons, because Microsoft was kind of being a stick in the mud and they really wanted people to use DirectVD. And the other thing was that just driver coverage wasn't great, because literally people were building the OpenGL stuff almost entirely to use the Quake engine or an engine that if functionally equivalent, you know, that didn't do anything too crazy.
So Microsoft was being a stick in the mud, trying to get people to use Direct3D. But at that time, they were pushing this retained mode thing, which I'm interested in, like for a historical curiosity, because it was a dead end, right? Like, what's the basic idea of that, Guy?
So a retained mode is a manner. It's kind of like SceneKit, basically. It's what you do is you describe your entire scene. So you would tell the graphics card that you've got a building over here. Here's the terrain. Here's a model, like he's an actor, that kind of thing. And you'd place them all in the world. And then you would just update it and tell them, you know, basically maybe you could move one around and tell it to draw the scene over and over. Now that sounds like a nice idea.
Yeah, sounds pretty good. You don't have to tell it ever, because otherwise the kind of contrast would be every single frame, you have to tell me every single pixel I need to draw, like, and every single triangle. Like, that's crazy. Just like, you know, sounds like you just set up your scene and it would draw it for you.
Yeah, so the problem with retained mode is that you can't change culling strategies and you can't do other clever stuff. So, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to describe this. If you're in a first-person shooter and you're running around and you're staring at a wall, you don't have to draw anything that's behind that wall because you can't, you know, the player can't see it. With a retain mode API, that's very difficult to do because it is considering everything in the scene anyway, regardless of whether or not it's going to be visible to the player. They work okay for some things, but they don't work well for everything. But Microsoft was really wedded to this idea for some reason at the time. I think because, like you say, it's sort of a higher level abstraction than the immediate mode.
Right, so it sounds like a good idea. It sounds like it's the way of the future.
Yeah, but it's not.
It was actually not even remotely. Like, it went even further the other way.
It's got the same sort of problem that, like, GL Begin, you know, GL Vertex, GL End does, is that it's something that seems much more approachable at first, but starts to break down if any of your use of it is non-trivial, right? There's always some trick you can do, something you know about your scene or about the world or about the approach you're taking to optimize things better if you're in the driver's seat. Whereas the scene graph APIs, they're great for throwing stuff together quickly, but But anytime you're building a game, a big ticket, like a AAA game, you want to be able to take advantage of the knowledge of your particular domain as much as you can. And SceneGraph APIs never give you that. They always, they always take some of that power away. And that's really the same tendency that's kind of leading to the new APIs, right? The stuff that we're going to get to later, like Metal on iOS and Mantle, the one from AMD on the PC, of they're again like giving developers more lower level power because they're calling for it, because they don't want things to be easy. They want the really challenging performance sensitive things to be possible. And if the API is getting in your way and trying to do a bunch of stuff, then it's hard to hit those goals.
Yeah. Which isn't to say that there's not a need or a space for something like SceneKit or a retained mode thing. But when Microsoft is pushing it as the only way to do 3D programming, that is...
In the late 90s, when the hardware is like barely able to do like 640 by 480 or 600 by 800,
Yeah, it's just a bad idea. It's not a tenable solution to the problem.
And there's been a couple other evolutionary dead ends like that as well. Like in that same era, there was the Fahrenheit initiative, which is like a thing that Microsoft worked on with SGI at the beginning of like the web accelerated graphics area. Google was pushing a SceneGraph like API that ended up losing pretty badly to WebGL. Like lots of vendors have said, hey, it would be really great if we just provide people with a simple API. And the problem is they always get rejected by the people that they need to be accepted by the most to be successful, like the actual serious game developers. Even if casual or not casual is even the right word, but like non-AAA games, indie games and stuff like that, like a lot of them will look at it and say, yeah, it'd be really nice to have something that I don't have to hire a graphics programmer to get this done. Whereas all the, Ubisoft and Activision, all them are just like, this is a joke. I don't want to deal with this crap. Give me a pointer to the command buffer, right, and a documentation on the GPU and let's go.
Yeah. Like a lot of those sort of initiatives, are kind of like 4GLs. Remember those 4GL languages?
Yeah. Where they're trying to be even higher level than,
yeah, you describe like a form and they would put a screen up and it's like that.
Or Prologue, really, where you can say a few things is true, like, buses are vehicles, cars are vehicles, and make some claims about vehicles, some claims about buses. And then you can ask a question like, does the bus have wheels? And it'll be like, yeah, it does. And just from the facts that you've told it. And so it's trying to be like, no one needs to, think about all these implementation details. Just tell it stuff and then it'll magically work. And it kind of worked until it didn't. And
that's the thing. It's kind of like, it's like an 80% solution, but not the right 80%, in a way.
The sweet spot for those kinds of APIs, I think, is putting 3D content into things that aren't 3D applications, right? You're writing like here's a program to manage my like video library, and I want to have a cool like cover flow style. I can pan through all of the covers of all my DVDs and, something like that, like something like SceneKit is great because you don't want to have to think about how any of this stuff works behind the hood. You just want to say, put these models at this position and then move them. And there's, a few dozen of them on screen at once and who the heck cares? And so for something like that, something like SceneKit is great because those people, like that world was kind of closed to them before if they had to just start writing OpenGL code. And something like SceneKit gives them all right, now I can put this 3D thing in my non-3D application in a pretty clean way, but it's not something for game developers for the most part.
So we've made our sort of progress through history up to, we've got GLQuake, and that's sort of the defining moment where OpenGL starts to getting sort of standardized. People are starting to kind of demand 3D acceleration in their computers, and you get a Voodoo sort of with their pass-through cards are getting priced out of the market and eventually end up, or I should say 3DFX with their Voodoo cards end up getting too expensive. And then ATI and NVIDIA all sort of come in and they're all, in effect, my understanding is the building direct 3D compatible cards at that point. It was basically the main focus once we get into like the early 2000s and Windows actually builds in good enough support for good enough APIs. And we talked a little bit about how Direct3D differed from OpenGL. Basically, this like kind of more object oriented and it's just modern because it's like C++ based and people are mostly building games on C++. But throughout that whole time, OpenGL didn't die, right? Like it was still being used, at least at the very least, the Macintosh completely does all its rendering on OpenGL, right?
Yeah. OpenGL didn't die on Windows, mostly just through Carmack's sheer force of will. I think that's fair to say. My first game, 3D game, I used OpenGL because I liked it better. And I thought, well, it's good enough for Carmack, it's good enough for me. But that was, DirectX. That was just before DirectX 5 kind of thing. But there, for years, sort of DirectX or Direct3D sort of began to outstrip OpenGL. OpenGL was interesting for quite a while because it has an extension mechanism. And individual vendors can extend it in different ways, which was cool if they would give you some like neat functionality. But not so cool if you had to build your engine and then, like, let's say NVIDIA had an idea for doing, I can't even
think. Anti-aliasing, let's say.
Sure, anti-aliasing or mipmaps or something. And NVIDIA would do it one way and then ATI would do it another way. So you'd have to support both if you wanted that feature in your game. So that kind of became a bit of a headache. And OpenGL didn't rev that often. Microsoft being, since they had total control of Direct3D. Each time they came out with a new version, they could work with the card manufacturers. They could figure out exactly what features they wanted to do, and they could push it forward faster. And OpenGL tended to stagnate at times.
I remember that in that era in the 2000s, and I'm not sure how much this is a thing anymore because I don't do Windows PCs anymore, but it was always like, this card is DirectX such and such compatible. Like, it's a DirectX 9 card or it's a DirectX 10 card. Like, what was the card doing in order to conform? Like, was Microsoft just saying, we'd like cards to have at least this much video memory or at least have, you know, programmable shaders that can do this and therefore we will certify it as compatible? Or was there things where you just couldn't possibly write a game with DirectX 8 unless it had X?
Mainly it was on features, like that each new version of DirectX would say, okay, here are some new features that we're introducing. So with one of the versions, like in the 7 or 8 era, they said, like, all right, now we're introducing programmable shader hardware, and any card that's going to be a DirectX, and I don't remember off the top of my head what the number is, card has programmable shader hardware, and you can depend on that, and you can write like HLSL code I think the first version was actually, we're still just doing assembly. Like, you had a little, you know, couple dozen instruction assembly language that you wrote in for the first round. And then for the next version, they said, okay, now you're doing like, you know, HLSL shaders and you write them in this language. And so for each version, there'd just be, here's a minimum set of features in terms of number of texture units and how big your shader programs can be and what, you know, do you support compute shaders? And each new version, they just introduce a bunch of stuff and all the hardware that's compatible with that version is, you know, has got those features, and so you can depend on them. And that was a big thing in terms of, you know, like Guy said, with Microsoft being able to rev faster and OpenGL having these kind of, yeah, you could get the stuff a little earlier on OpenGL because of the extensions, but you couldn't do it cross-vendor in any useful way. Whereas DirectX, if you said, like, I'm going to make a DirectX 9 game, then you just wrote to the feature set of DirectX 9 and you knew every card that it was going to run on, it would run pretty good on. Whereas OpenGL, it could be like you were writing for each individual vendor's graphics API. If you wanted to take it to that next level and use all those features, of course, there was a common subset that was fine. And, you know, again, there's the sort of difference between the high end and the low end of development is for people that are doing smaller games, indie games, whatever, you know, probably they would be fine with just like, all right, I've got like Vertex object extension and like a couple of other really common ones to get the basic performance threshold, and then you're good to go. You don't need to worry about, okay, how do I deal with this weird normal mapping mode or something like that, that this card supports differently from this card. You just didn't use that feature and, you know, sort of sucked it up.
So I want to do a sponsor, and then I want to talk about, we've kind of gotten to the peak of specialization in graphics cards, and then the sort of path as they've now become more general with programmable shaders and stuff. So this episode is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. Steam Clock makes wonderful apps for iOS, Android, and the web. If you're a Fortune 500, a startup, or somewhere in between, and you're looking to work with a team who sweats every pixel, learn more at www.steamclock.com. I feel like I want to have you like enter an offer code or something. But if you do actually contact Steam Clock based on hearing the show, then definitely say something. And I don't know how much of a discount can we guarantee, Nigel? We say like you get 10% off.
Definitely, we can give them 10% off.
Okay, you get 10% off on development services and design, which is like probably the world's most valuable offer code ever offered in a podcast. You can have some like, you know, five-figure project. We're like, yeah, we'll give you 10% off because you called in because of our podcast. Wow, that's great. I would be very excited if that actually turned into something. So the process of, you know, GPUs becoming more specialized and adding all these features that, you know, DirectX can require, sort of, at least my perception of it, is that it peaked once they became more generalizably programmable. So this is like programmable shaders. Is that kind of maybe the biggest evolutionary leap? Or is there maybe even a bigger one?
I'd say so. I think maybe GeForce 3 would be a big one, Nigel.
Yeah, like there were some intermediate ones, like Hardware Transform was definitely a big one as a developer. When I started, it was all transformation, like all the camera and vertex transformation, all that was done on the CPU side. It was just rasterizing the polygons. And so that was a big change, moving to Hardware Transform. There's been various things in terms of particular features, like anti-aliasing becoming mainstream was pretty huge. But I think if you had to pick like one thing other than the original transition from like non-hardware accelerated to hardware accelerated, probably the fixed function, rasterization / fixed function transform to like generalized shaders is probably the biggest next one. Cause it just opened up so many techniques that weren't tenable before, you know, like all of the things that people are doing now, like various kinds of deferred shading and, all sorts of crazy effects get opened up by having that. And so there's been a real increase in graphical richness over the last generation, I guess probably two generations now of hardware, where you've just kind of been able to assume that kind of stuff. And now the transition that's starting is the transition into like the compute and geometry shaders and stuff like that, where you're not just, you know, either not rendering out on the back end, you're pulling the data back out and, you know, doing something else with it, or you're generating geometry on the fly on the GPU rather than saying, here's my vertex buffer, do some stuff with it. You can say like, here's a NURBS patch, you know, here's a program to break down this NURBS patch into polygons on the fly on the GPU. And that's a transition that's just kind of starting now. Like, you know, there's hardware out there that can do it, but it's something that's not completely mainstream yet, because there's also lots of the lower end hardware that can't really do that stuff yet.
Yeah, that is a big new one, because, I mean, up until this point, you basically have the geometry that was going to be rendered is what you submitted to the card. But by adding this sort of new geometry shader stuff, you can generate vertexes on the card itself, which opens up a whole bunch of interesting opportunities.
Well, it's gotten to the point now where, like, you know, I guess the original thing is programmable shaders, where you can basically say, okay, I have a triangle, which a lot of people don't realize. We talk about polygons all the time, and I was always benchmarks, oh, it can render this many polygons a second. But, you know, for a long time, my understanding is that all polygons are triangles all the time, right? Like, if you want to make a square, you make it out of two triangles.
Yeah, that's pretty much true.
Right, which to me sounds insane. Like when I first heard that, I'm like, it can't possibly be true. Like that seems like a ridiculous thing to burden the programmer with saying, oh, you have to make two triangles if you want to make a square. But if the graphics card can be slightly more like just really, really good at doing one specific thing, it's always going to do that. And that in this case is triangles.
With that, there's actually a very simple reason why triangles are preferred, which is that with triangles, you're guaranteed that the polygon is planar, right? Like that you 3 points always lie in a plane with regards to each other. If you have 4 points, they might lie in a plane. You may have set them up so they lie in a plane, but they might not. And if they don't, then the graphics hardware has got some tough decisions to make because anything that's not planar, there's no single correct way to render it.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that, but like you basically define 4 points where like 3 of them make a flat triangle and the 4th one is lower and higher than on the plane than the other ones. Like you could say, okay, let's assume it's curved up to the point, or you can like, there's no sensible way to make sense of that. Like now that I say that, like for, I know that in older graphics cards in the like olden days that you could use like quadrangles and things like this as your primitives, you could use 4 point primitives. Did it just like error out if they were non-planar, or what did it do?
No, they would just break it down into triangles.
Oh, okay.
You could submit quads to OpenGL.
And it'll just split them into triangles.
Still can. And
yeah probably split, probably yeah. All you can, and it'll just tessellate it for you, but it'll have some rules for tessellating, right? If you've got a non-planar thing, it'll fold it basically between two of the points, and you don't have any control really over which 2 points those are going to be. Like there's, you know, you're not going to be able to depend on it rendering the same way on different hardware if it's non-planar.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you ever, for quads, for OpenGL, you'd only ever really use it for UI, like any, like stuff that faces the camera. You know what I mean? Like a rect on the screen. You can do lines in OpenGL too, but guess what happens? It, for every line, it puts two triangles and sticks them together. Very thin ones, but yeah.
That's funny. So programmer shaders are basically saying, okay, here's, run this little program, and the inputs of this program, like it could be a tiny, like I ended up writing one for one of the apps we did, which was a cool thing to be doing. But it was, I think, one line, which is basically input of where you are on the triangle, the coordinates on the triangle, and then you output colors. And then you just, it's whatever, you know, which sounds like the thing of a programmable shader sounds like this crazy voodoo, but it's just, no, it's a microscopic or maybe medium length program that takes a coordinate on a triangle and it outputs color. So that's kind of the start, but then you can also get to like, you know, vertex shaders and things like that, where that's, you know, if I understand.
Yeah. So stuff gets fancy because, I mean, yeah, you've got the point in where you are in the triangle. But where it gets kind of rocket science-y is that if you want to do bump mapping or if you want to do some kind of special effect, you have to take the incoming light vector and transform it into the texture space and do a whole bunch of other math.
So texture being applying some image basically to a surface which is probably made out of multiple or possibly made out of multiple triangles. And then bump mapping being converting the texture, not the texture being like, some visual, just sort of a flat visual thing, but it's information that determines how the light bounces off of it. So if you had like a brick wall and you made brick outlines, then it would actually make the light look like it was shining on the top of the bricks, but not the bottom.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how you achieve like many special effects these days. Or in, you know, for the, for if you got a shiny surface, like a chrome surface, you'd have an environment map, which is basically it's what it sounds like. It's the environment, it's the world that you're in. And you can figure out what should be reflected underneath the pixel that you're rendering. So yeah, like pixel shaders are pretty, like the idea is simple. What actually happens in them can end up getting pretty complex.
So is that stuff that's being handled like or OpenGL and Direct3D saying like, okay, in OpenGL, you're like new environment map or new bump map or whatever, or are you just writing like really crazy, ridiculous texture shaders or
the latter. You're writing the shaders yourself for the most part on any modern hardware. There was a sort of intermediate period there where some of that stuff leaked back and forth. Like the old way of handling that stuff, what's called fixed function, is where you'd have some of those things just built into the API. So you'd just say to OpenGL, here's a texture. I want you to treat this texture as an environment map. And it would have some, you know, it would have some rules about, all right, when I'm transforming these vertexes, like internally they had some equivalent of a shader but it was, you know, it was much more hard coded. And in the very early days of the Shang languages, you got a little bit of back and forth that some of those things could sort of appear in some ways in inside the shader code. Now it's pretty much just you do whatever you want. Like you just take in a block of vertex data and a block of constant register data that you've set up, and you just do whatever the heck you want on it.
It's kind of funny because in a way that they've removed all the niceties in a way.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Like it's really stripped down. So, you know, like you can't do GL begin and GL end anymore. You also don't get the, you know, effectively free environment mapping. That was kind of nice to have. But all of that stuff's gone in favor of being like, look, this is what we're about. We've got this programmable pipeline. And that's all we're going to do is have you feed the pipeline and then run our little programs on it.
It's almost kind of, maybe this is a weird metaphor, but I think of it like how cell phone companies used to be like, okay, here's all these functionalities that we're going to provide. You know, we have a data connection to your phone, but you're going to have SMS and MMS and phone calls and all these things. And like, oh yeah, if you search for, you know, Netflix on our phone on Verizon, then you get free data on it or something, like trying to be smart. But the sort of inevitable long-term thing is that there's going to be a dumb pipe that has bytes coming over it and then just going to compete on being really good at sending you bytes. And anything else is kind of a diversion on the inevitable path to just doing one thing well.
Yeah, and something like the removal of all of the fixed function stuff from OpenGL ES is definitely in that vein. Like there's people that are really annoyed about that. Like people that are small developers that are, you know, are not doing performance sensitive stuff that have OpenGL code and are trying to port it to OpenGLS. And, you know, you'll occasionally run across them in forums or in blog posts, like complaining about, oh,
frustrated.
You know, wasn't that big a deal to put this stuff in? Like, why couldn't they just put this stuff in? And that's kind of OpenGL's way too. Like there, the desktop version of OpenGL just has like all the layers of coral growth there of every feature that has ever been put into OpenGL is still kind of there in some form. And they've started to get better about pulling some of that stuff out. They stripped a lot of it out with OpenGL ES. They've been, I believe, more aggressive about deprecating that stuff on the desktop. But, you know, it's something that they're taking stuff away from people and people do get annoyed about it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they should because it's, I mean, I haven't been doing this for a long time. It's for the best in the long run. And they're certainly going in the right direction, I think.
So we have more than two decades of OpenGL coral growth in all sorts of various ways that, you know, the APIs have evolved to meet the changing graphics cards that were originally it was software rendering, and then it was, you know, hardware rendering, and then it was like specializing and adding all these features, and then now it's becoming more generalized. And this has been going around for 25 years, but to this day, or until a month ago, it was still this sort of headline. If you are building anything on the Mac, whether you know it or not, you're rendering, or on iOS, iPhone, iPad, you're rendering it with OpenGL. And then last month at WWDC, Apple dropped, I don't know if it's a bomb, but they definitely, right? Maybe it's the opposite of a bomb. They gave us a present, which is an entirely new API that is quite different, called Metal.
So I don't want to characterize OpenGL as being bad. I think it's still a good API. I think you can still achieve a lot of really cool stuff with it. And it has gotten better over the years because they have been. If there is 20 years of cruft there, which maybe we, you know, sure, but if you use the subset of like the new stuff, it's pretty lean and it can do a good job. That said, it doesn't quite match up with the way that GPUs work today, specifically GPUs and embedded devices.
Right. So my understanding of the iOS device's GPU, and although maybe this is out of date, maybe this isn't true anymore, but it's actually that it was a tile-based renderer, which is different.
That is true. It is still a tile-based renderer. Just to jump back a little bit, though, to the guy's comment about the, you know, whether or not OpenGL is still important. Like, that's something I've seen a little bit of sort of hand-wringing about this, is does this mean Apple's like got something against OpenGL? And I mean, there's no way to know for sure, but I kind of don't think they do. What I see is that the relationship between OpenGL and Metal is kind of the same relationship they were talking about earlier between like SceneKit and OpenGL, right? That they're, it's a stratification, right? That's going on of different people that are using the API for different reasons care about different things. Someone who's just like, you know, I'm doing a simple non game app that wants some 3D in it, you know, SceneKit is good for them. Someone who's, I'm doing an app where things like cross-platform capability are really important, or, you know, I don't have a lot of time to devote to micro-tweaking all of my graphic stuff, like OpenGL is the API for them. And Metal is just adding something new on the back end, right? Of saying, okay, right. Well, if you really care about performance, here's a new API that'll give you more performance. And probably to a certain degree, they're giving it to themselves as well. Like I would be kind of surprised if once the A7 becomes ubiquitous, like, you know, every iOS device that supports like iOS 9 or something has an A7. And I don't know if that'll be true, but probably it'll be true in 9 or 10 that they'll start doing like, all right, we're going to start targeting the windowing system against Metal instead of against OpenGL or stuff like that. Like the, you know, they can make use of having a friendlier API than like, here's the graphics driver, go nuts for doing high performance graphics stuff.
No, I totally agree. And I, that the point about stratification is dead on as far as I'm concerned. I don't think OpenGL will go away. I think it's still very useful. But you're right. Like in that 2% of the cases where you're running up against the limits of OpenGL, Metal is your trapdoor.
Like
Metal.
And I think they want to make it. I think they want to make it less than 2%. Like this is also a play for getting some higher end gaming stuff going on iOS. Right. This is a way to say to game developers, like, all right, now you can. You know, you can make like a AAA quality game and not compromise because we've got this API that that gives you back all of the overhead. You know, it kind of turns the iOS devices into a little bit of a game console, right? Like, game console APIs have always been like this. You don't use OpenGL. And even on Xbox, where you do use Direct3D, the version of Direct3D you use is different enough from the standard one that you know, Microsoft has stripped out some of this stuff as well in their APIs that they provide on the Xbox consoles, right? So, you know, I think it's a play to make it larger than 2%, in addition to giving the 2% that's there now something they want.
Right. No, I totally agree. And so the way the API is structured is basically the way these things work, right? Like you create a command buffer and you submit it to a queue and the GPU goes and does its work. And what's nice about Metal is that you can submit these command buffers on multiple threads, which you couldn't do with OpenGL, mostly because of the way the API works, because it's a giant state machine, right? So it's basically locked with thread. But Metal sort of really opens that up and you can do a lot of interesting tricks with that and basically take better advantage of the CPU.
So if you're doing an OpenGL app or game, you'd basically need to do whatever work you're going to do on your various threads, and then you have the OpenGL thread, which is the one that actually does the real drawing calls and things like that?
Yeah, that's the same way to do it. I'm sure there's some crazy people that do it the other way. But yeah, you'd effectively do whatever you had to do on a thread and then queue it onto your main thread and like do the you know, juggle it manually.
Really, the only work you can usefully do from another thread on OpenGL is if you're doing stuff like generating vertex data on the fly, where you're saying like, all right, I'm drawing this thing and I'm going to regenerate all the vertices for it every frame because it's some, you know, it's some effect that, and now you probably wouldn't even do that because you do a geometry shader, but you could say, all right, I'm going to like lock the memory for this vertex buffer on the main thread and then give that locked buffer to another thread to do the processing and then pull it back on. But from a practical standpoint with OpenGL, you're looking at single thread. And I don't know, and this is going to be a tough thing for OpenGL to deal with because Direct3D has also got some of this stuff as well. Like, I don't think it's quite as slick as it is in Metal or probably Mantle, the one that AMD's come out with is sort of targeting the same niche. But you know, D3D can handle it. I don't know how they're going to extend OpenGL to be multi-threaded. Like, the whole model is just kind of incompatible with it. So
yeah,
that'll be a weird transition.
Well, so you know what Carmack does with, I believe it's an OpenGL, with the Mega Texturing Engine. I should say id, I guess. But so they have two GL contexts, and you can share... Well, this is really getting into the weeds. But you know how you can set up two contexts to share each other's data?
Yeah, I think I've heard about this before.
So the mega texture will have a thread in the background loading up textures into this shared context so that the textures are ready to go by the time the other thread goes to render them. So you know what I mean? Like, you've got a thread loading up texture data that the other one's going to use. Either way, it's like, it's rocket science. You do not want to be touching. OpenGL with multiple threads is a pain.
So Metal Guy, I know you're looking into it a little bit. You wrote an article for Macworld, which is awesome, about how it works. And it wasn't necessarily intended to be like, once you read this, you are now a hardcore graphics programmer.
Yeah, but that was hard to write because I have no idea what the technical inclination of Macworld videos is.
Right. I mean, it's probably, you know, a little less technical, but in the same vein of listeners of this show, which is, you know, most of the folks are technical and they're interested in technology and stuff like that. But, you know, they're not necessarily, like, probably most people listen to it, 90% are not actually game programmers.
Yeah.
Probably maybe 99%.
The funny thing about Metal is that if you know enough to know why you want to use it, you don't need it explained to you.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know how you feel about that, Nashville, but like the...
It's like assembly code, right? It's like if someone's like, oh, should I write this in assembly code or should I write it in Objective-C?
Right.
Then like, if the fact that they're asking that question means they should not
write
it
in... You have enough ground. Yeah, like, you know, I called it 2% and Nigel correctly makes the argument. I think that Apple wants to expand that. But when you know, when you are running up against the bounds of OpenGL, you... know enough to know why you want to use Metal.
Right.
So it's more like you need to explain it to other people in a way that's kind of it's not like the goose that laid the golden egg. It's great. There's a lot of good uses for it. But it's more nuanced than just like, oh, look, Metal, everything goes faster.
Right, it's sort of like if that. You were never able to do assembly code on iOS until today, and they're like, now, here, we have assembly code, and look, this one video codec is 6 times faster, and everyone's like, wow, that's great, everything's going to be 6 times faster. It's like, well, you know, if you have something that's really stressing the system, and you are willing to have, you know, one or more people who are dedicated in their job to writing low-level API stuff, then maybe.
It is great, but it's not the be all and end all. Like, it's not going to change everybody's experience on iOS forever and ever. And that's the end of the story.
Although it's kind of, Nigel makes an interesting point that I hadn't thought of originally, and they didn't mention it because I guess they don't talk about future announcements or whatever, but that Apple's pitching it as being for game developers. But if they have this lower level thing that they, like, I guess another way of putting my question is there any way that the things they're doing in the windowing system, like putting up dialogues and doing things like the zoom animations and
maybe
the
dock,
that's going to benefit from Metal at some point?
Yeah, in fact, that kind of rendering is the kind of thing that benefits from an API like this. Like, the multi-threading stuff that Guy talked about is probably the biggest thing in terms of what, you know, what performance increase you could get out of this, because, you know, basically it means if you're CPU limited on rendering and you've got a dual core CPU, you can now use half the time that you were before, right? So that's the biggest increase by volume. But the other thing that Metal does is it strips away overhead, and overhead is particularly important for small rendering calls. Like, on basically all modern graphics hardware, if you, like, submitting any number of polygons up until like a few thousand is essentially kind of the same cost. Like, if you're going to draw one polygon, you might as well draw 1,000 polygons, because all of your overhead is going to be the same on that. And there's lots of little ways that overhead kind of eats into things when you're doing a polygon here, a polygon there. And so one of the things that an API like Metal that's got that reduced overhead gives you is it makes certain rendering techniques that have become implausible because you need to batch things up so much to get the modern hardware to like it, now they can become performant again. You can say like, all right, I'm just going to draw these five polygons, and you're not eating a huge amount of driver startup overhead to doing that. So something like a windowing system could really benefit from this sort of thing in theory. Like, I'd need to do more investigation to say like, oh yeah, this is the way it's for sure going to help. But in theory, like that, where that overhead bites you is on the low number of polygons in a draw call. And it seems like a UI has to be a low number of polygons in most draw calls.
Yeah, you're totally right. I would have the exact same analysis of it. It's like economy 101 classes, when you see the initial startup cost for, you know, doing your lemonade stand, and it's huge, so you better, doing one cup at a time is pointless. It's very much the same kind of thing. And one thing I hadn't thought of, but I got a very nice note from a guy from Power VR in response to my Macworld piece. Well, I say very nice. He tells me I'm wrong in a couple of places, but he does it in a nice way. And
that's helpful, though.
Yeah. I thought it was great that he reached out. He makes the point that nobody has yet been talking about how this reduced overhead and command submission consumes less power.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't even thought of that until he pointed it out. And he spends like two paragraphs explaining it. And it's like, oh, that really is a big deal. And I hadn't thought about that. Because of the CPU overhead is lower for command submission, the system on a chip, the A7, is consuming less power. Like, it's lit up less often. And especially to Nigel's point about it being good for UI, that'd be great for UI, because you're not having to do this initial kick up all the time. So,
and there's some of the elements of overhead, and I'm going to get a bit into the weeds here on what I know for sure, but I will give something that's sort of representative, and it could be wrong to like the couple of people who work at graphics card vendors. Yeah. But there's some of the overhead that's sort of simple, just overhead of like, all right, well, if you got the API, you can write a particular piece of state, and you got to be able to read that back. Then you got to like store it internally. You know, in Metal, none of the set functions have get functions associated with them, right? It's all just write only. And that, that just takes a little bit of overhead off every API call. But then there's a few things where things are just unreasonably expensive. And one thing, I don't know if it's a problem specifically on like the Power VR hardware, but I know is a problem on some hardware, is like retargeting a Vertex program at a different Vertex format.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you'll say like, all right, I've got this Vertex program and it needs a color and a Vertex position and a texture coordinate. And then you say, all right, here's my one Vertex format that's got a color and a Vertex position and a texture coordinate. And then it's got this one other texture coordinate, right? And then I've got my second Vertex format that's got a Vertex position and two colors and a texture coordinate. And you say, yeah, I'm just going to use this shader for both of those. Well, retargeting the Vertex shader at those two different Vertex formats is a really expensive operation. Like, it's essentially a recompile of the Vertex shader in order to do that. But it's something that you can't represent that in any way in OpenGL. Like, there's no way to represent, here's a Vertex shader and the Vertex format associated with it. Like, you just, you set that stuff in the state machine, and then when you say render, it can look and say, okay, have I got the correct Vertex shader for this Vertex format? And if not, I gotta compile it right now. Yeah. And there's cases in the middle of a frame. And there's cases like that. Like, I think in the case of the Vertex shader one, it just sort of, the first time it sees any given combination of Vertex shader and Vertex format, it compiles one and caches it. And then you use it again later and it'll use the cache version rather than recompiling it. But I think there are some state operations like that that it ends up redoing all the time, that you'll do a particular combination of flags that puts it in some mode where it's like, all right, well, now I got to go through and build up this one internal structure. And Metal and other APIs like that, D3D even is better about this than OpenGL, will give you like blocks of state that it knows are dangerous in that way, right? You'll say, here's a block of state that represents this particular piece of the environment, and you set up that block and poke it with all those things, and then you just, all right, I'm just going to take that and put it off somewhere else, and I'll just reuse it all the time when I'm submitting graphics commands. And you know that, you know, it's not going to cost you anything unless you change that piece of state. And they call this out in like the metal documentation of like, here's the objects that we expect to be transient, like, you know, individual command buffers and stuff like that. It's like, here's the objects that we expect to be cached, that you'll like create this once and then reuse it. And there's even a couple of them that says like, changing this one is expensive. Don't change this one. Just set up all of the ones that you need at the beginning of the program and then reuse them every time you use them. And, you know, stuff like that, like anything where you've got some expensive CPU operation that you're having to potentially constantly redo, like, yeah, it burns time, it burns power.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a sore spot on OpenGL for, you know, since they got the shading language. So I don't know when that was, 3-something. Because OpenGL, you need to ship the shader code itself, and then it compiles it in the driver. Like, it's just for the listeners, it actually looks kind of like C code. It's literally code. And many people for a long time have been trying to get the Kronos group, the people in charge of OpenGL, to have an intermediate language, which basically compiles down the code into something that's more easily compiled. Because, yeah, like this recompile on OpenGL can be a serious issue. And yeah, caching is nice, but there's always some pathological thing that's going to keep screwing up your cache. But yeah, with Metal, you really do. You basically vet some state once, and then you're good to go. So it's much faster, or it has the potential to be much faster, I should say.
Yeah, that business of compiling little bits of C, I was very surprised about how it actually worked when we were working on this one. We did a 3D map of the internet project at SteamClock, which Nigel did a couple shaders, and I was editing them. And I would like make a typo in the shader, and then the app would like not. It would just be a black square, and I'm like, "What? Why? What's happening?"
It's like, a black square is like that's the default state for OpenGL. It's just it never works.
99.999% of all compilable OpenGL applications will render a black square.
Our rule of thumb for porting games at Radical was always 2 weeks to get the first polygon appearing on screen, and then 2 weeks to get the entire rest of the graphics engine.
I've had that exact thing at Ubisoft, actually, where it's like you bust your ass trying to just to get anything on screen. And then once you've got one little thing, you're like, okay, if it's, you know, you can make progress. Yeah, we brought up on the PSP, we did Splinter Cell. Took us forever to see the first thing on the screen.
So those devices like PSP and the PS3, PS4, they're not using OpenGL. They're not using Direct3D. What are they like? Are they basically creating a new graphics API, like some C++ API from scratch, where every time they do a new console, and they're like, "Oh yeah, by the way, here's some API." Or
yeah, well, kind of.
That sounds horrible.
So the Nintendo stuff. Whatever. I'm sure I signed an NDA, but who cares? It's been long enough. The Nintendo stuff looks a lot like, or at least on the N64, it looks a lot like OpenGL. The PSP had an OpenGL feeling graphics API. But with all of this hardware, you can, it's not like on the iPhone or an iOS device where you must use the APIs. On these devices, you get to mess with stuff at a much lower level, and invariably at like maybe not the launch titles, but like the ones after that, you've learned how to mess around with the hardware itself. On the PS2, it was crazy. You had to program all these what were they called again? VPUs.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, vector processing.
Is that basically like assembly language for some weird?
Well, it's not even that. It's more like you tweak a bunch of settings, and then like do a DMA transfer.
Oh yeah, the PS2, like basically the API for the PS2 was just a function saying DMA the memory at this location.
So DMA means direct memory access.
Yeah. Like the API was just a set of documentation of like here's what the command structure for the GPU is. Like you just you sent the exact rendering commands that you needed directly to the GPU, and that was, you know, there wasn't really an API. You built up command buffers, and to a certain degree, that's, you know, that's what's going on with most of the higher level APIs. Is you're always, you know, you've got some block of memory that's command buffer. You're writing elements into that command buffer, and then at some point you say, all right, now I'm going to send this command buffer to the GPU, and you sort of tell the GPU that the command buffer is ready. And the lower level APIs like Metal and stuff like that make that a lot more explicit. And on the game consoles, it's a lot more explicit as well. Usually the focus of the API is, here's the layout of the graphics command format, and send it to the hardware. And when it's a higher level API, it's usually even sort of in terms of that. Like, even if there's a higher level API, it'll be like, all right, set this state, and it'll give you the exact, like, here's the integer values that you're going to write to the GPU for that state, so that the command buffer is very thin. You know, OpenGL, you say, I want to set this piece of state, and I'll have to go and look up the enum that you passed in some table and figure out exactly what that corresponds to on the real hardware, and maybe, you know, grab some other piece of state and merge it with it and do a whole bunch of work. Whereas when you're dealing with a console API, even when it looks like OpenGL or D3D, it tends to be the, you know, the real values that you're passing in are like the actual ones that the hardware wants. And the API entry points tend to just be, okay, write that thing into the command buffer at the current location, and then I'm done.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, I mean, in a way, Metal is sort of like Apple's way of doing that, in that this very closely matches what is actually happening on the GPU. And but it's Apple, so it's still like a little bit higher level, and they're not going to let you directly poke at little bits of their chip. Which is a good idea, because iOS has been moving quickly. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they, you know, they have good API abstractions, and they can drag people along without tying them to the, I was about to say tying them to the Metal, but tying them to the tying them to the hardware of the particular, of any particular model.
And also, the environment is a lot different on your phone than it is on PlayStation. So on a PlayStation 2, if you do send some invalid thing to the graphics card and the entire, you know, video system just derps and the thing has to reboot, then it's like, well, yeah, you lost your progress in your game, but you didn't lose like the ability to make phone calls, or, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, this is the PlayStation 2, or even, you know, something like an Xbox One or a modern system. You're not relying on it for everything. You're relying on it for what you're using it for right this second, for the
right.
most part.
Yeah, blowing up somebody's phone is verboten. Do not. That's horrible. It's the worst thing to do. It's like, rebooting somebody's phone is bad mojo.
Yeah, because while it's rebooting, you're like, oh, this is boring. I should like check my RSS or something.
But you can't, because your phone's dead.
Yeah, it's the worst 1 minute of your life. So the last thing that I had on my list, and definitely Guy, feel free to like chime in or add to any other things that you have in mind. But the last thing I had was, I remember reading a story about a year ago about John Carmack. All stories about graphics programming and APIs have to come back to him at some point. And he was struggling with the Oculus dev kits, trying to, you know, for 3D virtual reality stuff, you need to have an extremely low latency in between the motion of your head and the rendering frames coming up and being rendered. And he was struggling to get it fast enough that it felt real, because the graphics drivers were buffering. And basically he was saying in OpenGL, draw this thing. And the graphics card's like, okay, I drew it. But the graphics card was lying.
Oh, yeah. It
was like, oh yeah, it'll eventually draw it in a while being like 10 milliseconds later, which is, you know, sounds really fast, but actually that's like motion sickness inducing amount of time later. Would something like Metal, or maybe Glide, which, or not Glide, what was the
Mantle,
which is the
AMD one.
Sort of AMD equivalent of Metal, is that going to help that, or is that at a whole nother level?
I don't know where he was getting his latency from.
Like in the driver, like basically the OpenGL commands that he was making didn't have enough control to tell the thing, no, draw it right this second. Like the driver and the card were, you know, conspiring to buffer and
delay. Yeah, I think probably what you could do is so there's two, in GL there's two, there's a GL flush and GL finish. GL flush basically sends all of the commands you've done up to that point to the graphics driver. GL finish, I think, doesn't return until everything's been rendered. I don't know, Nigel, is that the promise?
I can never remember what the difference between GL flush and GL finish is. And the other thing with GL flush and GL finish is anytime you have to call them, you've kind of failed.
You've screwed up anyway.
So and the other thing is, it's not worth remembering which one.
Yeah, you screwed up. And the other thing is, there are other calls that will cause, like implicitly call a flush or a finish. Like if you do a get error, so OpenGL never returns errors. If you need to figure out if you've got an error, you call GL get error. But in order to determine if there's an error, everything that's been submitted to the card up to that point has to run through the driver. So that causes an implicit finish. I believe it's a finish.
And that's a performance improvement that Metal has, right? Because you can deal with errors without waiting for the entire.
Yeah, you don't have to. Right? You don't have to do the thing. So I don't know. It would depend where his latency is. Now, one thing with GL drivers is that they can lie to you because they can obey the contract of OpenGL. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the thing that you've done is actually up on the screen at that point. Not only that, and this is not the case for Carmack, I'm sure, but most LCD screens, like the screens that you'd play your games on, certainly in the living room, can buffer frames.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's a lot. I mean, you can put it into game mode, but probably most people don't think about that. It would depend where his latency exactly was happening. Would Metal help that? It's a lower level thing, so it makes fewer promises. Well, sorry, I shouldn't say it makes fewer promises. I think it is more likely that you would be able to address this latency issue with Metal. That said, it could, I don't know where it could just be a driver thing. It could be a buffering thing. It could be, this is not the case for him, but like the way the tile renderer works could cause some lag. 10 milliseconds seems quite a bit.
Yeah, I think frankly. I think in this case, what he ended up doing is he ended up hassling enough people at NVIDIA to give him a custom build of the driver that would just like insta flush everything or something like that, which reduced performance but increased the speed that he could get a pixel on the screen.
Oh, okay. So yeah. So in that case, probably Metal would help. Like that seems to me that, and again, like when these guys, NVIDIA and ATI and Intel, I guess these days, when they gin up their drivers, they do some dirty tricks. Like that's what I mean by OpenGL. You can meet the contract that OpenGL demands without actually having put something up on the screen. Do you know what I mean? So that's probably where that latency is coming from.
Yeah, when this is true in almost any API, graphics or not, like one of the fastest ways that you speed things up is by immediately returning and saying like, okay, whatever you asked me to do is now done. Like, you save this file to disk. And you're like, okay, I saved it. And then you go off and eventually maybe save it to the disk. Or maybe you don't. Maybe the computer crashes before you save it. And most of the time that's fine. But then sometimes you have a backup application that's like, no, I really need to know that this actually did finish every byte saved to disk.
Yeah.
And it's on the disk now. It's not in some memory cache in the disk or something, you know?
Yeah. Nigel, would you guess that, what do you guess that problem is with the latency there?
If they were able to give him new drivers that fixed it, then probably if you were doing that same application on an iOS device and GL was giving you problems, then Metal would fix it. That would be my guess off the top of my head is it's an element of latency that they put into the drivers to work around some problem. Some of it's them trying to game benchmarks and some of it's also just that they have to deal with some extremely crummy instruction streams coming in from games, right? That they're, they're in the situation where they've got all these high profile games tossing stuff at their graphics card. And all it takes is one programmer to make some mistake and not catch it. And they'll have some weird case of like, oh, this guy did this thing wrong on this important game. And it's soaking away all this performance. And they work really closely during development with the big vendors to try and get that stuff sorted out, like try and make sure that everyone's using the API in a good way, but they can't catch everything. And when a game gets out into the wild with some performance problem that's due to using a slow path inside the driver, they'll do driver fixes for it to try and speed it up, to try and get the performance back. And, you know, you put enough of those things in and eventually there's going to be stuff where performance will be leached away due to the latency that they have to introduce to catch things that are going on. Whereas, yeah, what you want when you're saying, I want to get something on screen as fast as possible for this specific application is you just want, you know, all right, I made my command buffer here, GPU, start rendering this command buffer. And the second that API call finishes, the GPU is reading from that memory and processing it. And Metal gives you something a lot closer to that. So I would assume that Metal would solve that problem. Now, like you say, there could be other problems. Like it's possible for the hardware to have latency too. And then some cases you can fix it with the driver by tweaking how the hardware is used in some ways. But a lot of times then you can't. Like if the hardware just has to buffer a whole frame. And I would expect a tiled renderer like the Power VR to be worse in that respect in some cases, because it sometimes might need to wait longer before it starts rendering because it needs to know more about the environment to start submitting stuff to the first tile. But I don't know for sure. That's just a guess.
Well, I'm glad that these new APIs exist for people who are much, much smarter than I am to make our games and apps faster. So, Guy, where can people go to find what you're working on? What's new in the world of Guy?
New in the world of Guy? I have a podcast called Debug, giant joy, because I get to talk to very smart people all the time. And I have an app called Napkin, which you can find it on the App Store, at the Mac App Store.
Excellent. So I encourage everyone to do that. If you like the show, you can subscribe at upup.fm. If you didn't like the show, then you could also do that. I don't know why you would, but you could also send us email, hello@upup.fm. You can also find us on iTunes for reviews or subscription, and see you next week.
Thanks, guys. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And now we have our little post-show thing where I normally ask people, have you played any good games recently? Although I know probably when you're running a podcast, which the most recent episode I think that I finished listening to was about 400 hours long of awesomeness. So I'm not sure when you're recording that much and also working and doing apps and things and writing.
Oh, you're talking about
a lot of time to play games.
The Need and Ganatra show?
Yeah, that was possibly the best podcast episode of all time. Can count the three things as an
episode. It went crazy. I thought we would do like an hour. That was the plan. And just the initial thing was like four and a half, five hours.
So were you just really lucky that everyone involved had 4 hours from when you start? Or did you like start at midnight and just keep going and like Renee is like fallen completely asleep?
I guess we were just lucky. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Renee had to work in between.
He was working.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
He might have just gone and like run errands or something.
Well, at one point we literally took a bathroom break. It's like, okay, like we got to go to the bathroom at this point. It's crazy. But Neaton just kept talking. So
for anyone who hasn't heard this yet, if you'd like Up, I'm sure you would like this episode or probably all of Debug, but especially this episode. Neaton Ganatra was one of the senior folks. He worked at Apple for a long time, and so he tells the story when what ends up being a three-part podcast episode. The first part being sort of the 90s era Apple. The middle part being the original development of the iPhone, which is just like rivetedly fascinating if you're at all into that stuff. Like I worked at Apple and I was like, wow, this is extremely interesting. So, and then the third part was sort of the post iPhone, iPad and kind of just the process of building products that you've almost certainly used. And he was extremely involved and running the apps team or the team that wrote a lot of the apps that shipped with the system.
So. Fascinating, down to earth, very approachable guy. I was kind of shocked when I met him. I don't know. You expect somebody like a big shot to be aloof in some way, and he's not at all. He's just a very nice guy.
I find, I mean, this is obviously a gross generalization, but when people become successful enough that they let themselves start being aloof, then often their success tends to slow down or stop at that point.
Yeah.
You know, if you're LeBron James or something, then maybe that doesn't happen. But, you know, if it's about being creative and building stuff, especially in software, you need to maintain a certain humbleness and a certain willingness to think of your limitations and faults and stuff in order to keep learning at the rate you need to in order to...
Yeah, I think that's software. That's a good take and a hopeful one. I like it.
So any that's good, a no. You haven't been had a chance to
play I've been playing Batman Arkham City. Like pretty,
oh, how is that?
Pretty much constantly.
Oh, wait a minute. Arkham City, like the one from a couple years ago? Or the
yeah,
new
the one?
One
from a couple of years ago, because now it's available on my Mac, and I play it on my Mac Pro.
Right.
Just because I spend a bunch of money to play, to play old games I could have played on a console.
Hey, there's another interesting, just like very minor sidelight before we go on with this, is I'm kind of curious to see if Metal will come to the Mac at some point, because
yeah,
it could be very interesting in the context of like the Mac Pro and that extra GPU that's just chillaxing, waiting for something to happen to it in there.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it's kind of predicated on the idea of shared memory, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. But I think... modern GPUs, even on PCs and Macs as well, are pretty shared memory-y as well.
Like, right, like I could see PCI it in a laptop Express, for you sure, can, right? Well, yeah, I guess PCI Express. Can you map something?
I believe so. I think that that you can just map like CPU memory into the address space of the GPU and vice versa across the PCI Express bus.
So what's the order? How much slower is the PCI Express bus that the CPU has to talk to a GPU over on like a Mac? How much slower is that than the memory being on the GPU? Is it 100 times slower, 10 times slower,
oof,
a million times slower?
It's going to be somewhere more like 10 than
yeah,
100 or a million.
Because right, if it's only 10 times slower, you I can mean, imagine
could,
it being
I could buy 100, but certainly yeah, it's not thousands of times slower.
Those are my guesses too. Like
that, or at least unless you've got something like embedded frame buffer memory, like they got that on both the Xbox 360 and the Xbox One, is they have this like 10 megs on the 360. I don't know how much it is on the Xbox One of like embedded DRAM that you use for the frame buffer, and that stuff's
fast.
Wicked fast. That's yeah, like having your frame buffer in like L1 cache.
Yeah, right.
But the rest of the memory on the chip isn't going to be that much closer than main memory across the PCI Express bus.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about was the compute, which I think is interesting.
The OpenCL kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of funny that they didn't put OpenCL on iOS, but they do have Metal, which will do the same thing. So
does Metal have explicit parts of the API where it's like,
just for
okay,
compute.
I'm going to do this just for compute?
Yep, exactly.
Yes.
Which is cool. Yeah. I'm sure Chris Lysio is going to take advantage of it.
Is that them
maybe
a
don't
sign
put that in the... he hasn't actually told me that, but I just want to make sure I'm not announcing anything for his product because I don't know.
Okay, so now I'll bleep out who you're talking about.
Well, you don't have to bleep it. Whatever. I honestly don't know. I said I'm sure, but I frankly
okay,
don't know.
Okay, just seems
know,
like the
I,
kind of thing he would do.
Yeah, exactly. Seems up right, his alley. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it would be interesting to see. It's something that like OpenCL has existed on the Mac for quite a few years now, and I don't see a lot of things where... I mean, although I believe Capo on the Mac uses...
Capo does it a lot.
Yeah.
I know VoodooPad... sorry. Wow. Acorn does it because I...
right, of course.
Because I wrote that bit.
Right, so that would be a way you would know.
That yes.
Acorn being the excellent...
Gus has since put a lot of work into it, and he's made it way, way faster. Acorn is the excellent image editor for humans.
Yes. Yeah. So if you're a human and you have a Mac, well, if you're a human, then you probably should have a Mac. But
yeah, but I was so happy when he asked me to do that because I'm like, oh man, I get to write some OpenCL code. That's going to be fun.
I wonder, actually, this is I don't normally do this, call to listeners. If you're a subscriber to the show or a regular listener and you don't have a Mac and like we keep talking about Macs and iOS stuff and you're like, why do these guys just keep, because like a lot of gamers maybe only have consoles and Windows computers because like there's games. So write me an angry email if you're like, no, I don't have a Mac. I don't want to hear about this Mac stuff. And we'll maybe listen to you.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard of that. If you're a gamer yeah, without a Mac, and you must be laughing at me for buying a Mac Pro. to play right, to play 2 year like old games. Super...
Arkham City. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. It looks nice. It's the dumbest thing.
Though. Are you playing Arkham City with a gamepad, or are you playing with mouse and keyboard?
Mouse and keyboard.
Oh man!
I know. I'm gonna get. I'll get an Xbox One for the next one, Arkham Knight.
Right.
I still don't have a bunch of my friends worked on Arkham Origins, and I still haven't played that because it's not out on the Mac.
Yeah, I know people. There's at least one ex-Radicalite, Eric Holmes, who's like the creative director at Warner Brothers Montreal. That did
it. So I don't know that guy, but I've heard that name around. Yeah.
I've heard some pretty things about it though. Like I'm waiting for the bargain bin on that one. I enjoyed the first two so much that I feel like I'll have to try it eventually. But I've heard so many questionable things.
It's often
about
hard
it.
To tell when you hear those sort of mixed reviews for a huge franchise. Like we talked about this before about the Battlefield of Honor type franchises where they're on the 18th game, and like some of the games are some of the most famous games of all time are in that series. And then one comes out and it's like the word on the street is, it's kind of sucks. But really what they're saying is it's not the best first-person shooter of all time, and if you've played the previous one, then there's not much to it, as opposed to sometimes it's like, okay, actually, yeah, it started to suck.
So what I probably shouldn't be saying this, but whatever, what I heard was that Warner Brothers management was like, well, that one was that's our fault.
Oh, wow.
Because they told them to go do the exact same thing, and they went
and then it was
they
the
went
exact
and did
same
the exact
thing.
Same thing, and everybody's like, well, that's the exact same thing. And that's a very rare thing when management is like, yeah, our bad.
That's good, though. Like, I think
it's great.
If it's true, that speaks that well for the management that they were like, yeah, we made the wrong call on this, and it's not on the dev team, as opposed to, like, you guys screwed it up, you're all fired, which is something that would not be uncommon for that sort of thing happening.
Couldn't agree more. Like, a guy that was on the team is like, whoa, this would never have happened at EA. Like, at EA, you just... they'd cut you. So
people really underestimate leaders, especially people who are new leaders or just not used to being a leader, underestimate how much just being honestly and taking responsibility for problems.
Yeah.
Increase loyalty, right? It's like short term, some people will be like, yeah, you're right, you are an idiot, I'm gonna quit. But in the people who stay and they can trust you to be like, hey, if you did screw up, then they trust you to like, maybe you're gonna learn from that. Yeah. Rather than,
well, to be fair,
why did you guys all go do what I said?
Right,
you're fired.
Yeah. To be fair, I think the game did well. I don't think
I think it was profitable.
Yes, I think it was profitable. So, you know, good work, business accomplished. It got a little bit panned. And I think the fact that it wasn't Rocksteady, too, mm-hmm. people were just, you know, they already wanted to kind of bash it. So,
yeah. But certainly Arkham City is fantastic.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And when I say I'm playing it, I'm finished it. I go in there every night and just beat people up because.
You've even gotten all the achievements, found all the Riddler trophies. You're just beating up people that respawn over and over again for hours.
It's close.
No one's gotten all the Riddler trophies. Are you kidding me?
I haven't.
The Riddler trophies are ridiculous. I don't think anyone who has a job could possibly get all the Riddler trophies.
No.
You have to be unemployed in order to have gotten all the Riddler trophies.
I don't understand it. Let me just pay you money and unlock everything. I would happily do that. Because at this point, I'm like, oh, man, I've got to go pick up Riddler trophies so I can, like, unlock a new challenge map.
That's actually, I would be surprised if they don't have and unlock all of that stuff on the consoles, at least, in DLC. What they might not have is a DLC store set up for the Mac port.
Maybe. I don't know. I got the Game of the Year edition thing, so it just got, in theory, it's supposed to have everything, but who knows?
Often what you're asking for, which is like, oh, I'm spending all this time and now I just want to unlock everything. Like the game industry obviously loves that. It's like people who have a job and don't have the time to unlock everything, but they want everything.
Yeah.
That's kind of their bread and butter nowadays is the ability to flip a bite and then.
Yeah. And you know what? And it's not a multiplayer game. So,
yeah, so why
who cares,
not?
Right? Like, yeah. If I want to rob myself of the pleasure of trying to find that stupid Riddle trophy, then. What do you care?
Well, I can make fun of that, but I'm pretty excited to pay more money for Hearthstone, which is the only free-to-play game that I've played more than a few hours that I can think of. And I've been playing it kind of on and off, and an expansion is coming out. Original game was free. Expansion is something like $20 to unlock all the content. And I'm like, yeah, I know for sure I'm going to, I mean, I'll try the first part, which is free, just in case it suddenly is somehow horrible. Yeah. But I have pretty high expectations.
I still haven't played that, but everybody seems to like it.
I've started playing it now, finally. Alan kept poking me for, I don't know, at least a month or two about it, and I finally got it. And it is really good for what it is. I don't know how much longevity it's going to have for me, but it's definitely, like, as an example of a digitized version of a collectible card game, like, they've totally knocked it out of the park. Like,
oh, that's cool. I'll check it out.
The gameplay and the attention to detail and everything is just off the charts.
I'll check it out. I mean, it wasn't them, but they were in the news recently for being idiots.
Blizzard?
No. Somebody was running a tournament of Hearthstone.
Oh, yeah.
And it was gender specific, which is like, that does not make any sense. But apparently Blizzard stepped in and was like, don't be idiots. And they've changed the rules now.
Yeah, this is a tournament where they're saying no girls allowed. Because it was organization. It was like, really? It's like, it's a tree fork with it. I understand how it came from. It was that, like, what they were trying to do is establish a girls' league and a guys' league. And what instead they probably should have done is establish a women-specific league and an everyone league.
Yeah, that's I think, the big mistake there. Like, given that some of those games, and I don't know for sure if this is true of Hearthstone. Like, Hearthstone's something I could see actually there being plenty of women playing it, but there's certainly lots of games where if you don't at least have a women's only league, you're just going to get drowned out. Like, if there's only 20% of women playing, then you're just not going to see them in the main tournament, just sort of due to statistics. Like, nothing, you know, nothing to say that they're worse players, but just like, if there's a fifth as many, then
sure,
you know, they'll get taken out at each level of the tournament. And there's lots of sporting events that are like that, where they, and that's true actually of most professional sports, is that most professional sports, the, what we think of as the men's league, women could actually be in it if they wanted to.
Yeah, like, and the NHL, in the case of most sports,
like, the, you know,
is that true?
Testosterone is enough of a factor that women usually can't be competitive. But there's some, like, chess is a good example of that, right? Where there's a women's chess league, but the strongest female player in the world, whose name I'm going to look up, I believe it's Judit Polgar, who is the strongest female player in the world, does not play in the women's league. She only plays in, like, the main league, which is, you would think of as the men's league, but it's not open to women if they want to.
And it is true, Guy, that in the NHL women can play. There was an example of a female goaltender who was officially on the NHL roster to play, like, an exhibition game back in the day. And inevitably, just statistically over time, eventually there will be a woman. And, like, goaltending is a pretty good first position for that, because it's less physical. As far as, like, physical strength, raw strength doesn't matter as much. And so that's probably the gateway position for that,
I did not know that. That's cool.
But yeah, the whole thing with the tournament is a situation where clearly they were trying to do that, but didn't understand the right way to do it. Right? That it's you say, okay, we're going to give, you know, if there's less women in the tournament than men, we'll give the women a chance to, you know, to sort of show off their stuff, but women can be in the main tournament, whereas saying, oh no, women can't be in the main tournament, it's men only.
Like the no girls allowed is like, what, how old are you?
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah,
you're like, you're not serving video games well, or games at all well, but
no,
you know, no girls.
And it's awesome that Blizzard stepped in and said,
yeah, I thought that was great. Not happening. That was great.
Yeah, and it happened within a few hours, like off time zone too, so like obviously someone got a call. So that's good.
Yeah, that is cool. World is a better place for playing video games.